You're listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Appraisals in Commercial, Real Estate Finance, and Development. I am pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Philadelphia is Richard Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg is a retired partner of Ballard Spahr LLP. Mr. Goldberg has more than 40 years' experience in real estate and law practice and with a major national developer. He is past president of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers and past chair of the Anglo-American Real Property Institute. He is also a fellow of the American College of Mortgage Attorneys. Mr. Goldberg will serve as the leader for today's program. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Mr. Licata is a partner of Taz, Centenius, and Hollister LLP, where he has formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development, leasing, and land use. He formerly served as an adjunct professor at Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and at Illinois Institute of Technology. Mr. Goldberg, I am pleased to hand the program over to you.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and welcome, everybody. In the next hour, Tony and I are going to be talking about the use of appraisals in real estate transactions in a number of different ways. We're going to be talking about the drafting of appraisal clauses for these various kinds of transactions, and we're going to talk about what lawyers should be or should not be playing in appraisals. And before we go on, I'd like Tony just to tell you something that we're just not going to talk about because I think it's very, very important when we deal in the world of appraisals to define the subject. Tony?
Thanks, Dick, and it's a pleasure to be with you again on a panel, and always a pleasure to participate in these continuing education programs. We wanted to talk about, at the very outset, a couple of things that we are not going to get into and cover. The first one is there is a very complex regulatory scheme that's applicable to the legal requirements for when certain types of transactions have to obtain appraisals from state-certified real estate appraisers. These requirements generally apply to loans that are made by institutions, which are defined as being what they call, quote, a federally related transaction. And these are usually made by banks, Fannie Mae lenders, HUD lenders, et cetera. And these requirements arise under two main federal statutes. One of them is the called the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act, commonly known as FIREA. So in your practice, you'll hear people talking about having to get a FIREA appraisal. That's what they're talking about. It was adopted after the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. Dick and I may be the only people old enough on this call to have practiced through that. And then more recently, the Dodd-Frank legislation, which was enacted after the bailouts associated with the Great Recession. The details of that regulatory scheme, which generally apply to categories of lenders and what they have to do to comply with the law, as we say, are beyond the scope of our program today. This is not a bank lending regulatory type of a program. And then secondly, there are a whole raft of standards that are applicable to the appraisal industry itself. Those are generally promulgated under something called the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, known as USPAP, USPAP. And those standards are 66 pages long. There's tons of rulings interpreting them. And again, that topic is beyond the scope of what we're wanting to talk about today. What we're trying to do today is talk about pointers and tips that would be helpful to practicing lawyers who confront real estate appraisal issues in their transactions practice in various aspects. So, Dick, I hand it back to you. Hope that wasn't too long.
No, that was great, Tony. Yeah. Thank you very much. Let's talk about the instances where appraisals are likely to be used, and we're going to eliminate, as I said, as Tony just mentioned, most of the aspects of obtaining financing because they are subject to other things, and frankly, as lawyers, unless you represent the lender, you are not likely to get involved. And even if you represent the lender, I think in all likelihood you will not get involved in the appraisal process, you know, other than in perhaps drafting language in a commitment. So let's talk about the most substantial use that you have for appraisals. rent resets is the one that I have come across most often. And rent resets occur in several different ways. Of course, long-term ground leases typically will have a rent reset. And if you don't have a rent reset, you need to, if you're representing the lessor here, you need to take the pulse of your client to see if they're still living. because on any kind of a long-term ground lease, obviously, rent resets are very, very significant. You will also find them in space leases. And frequently you will have a rent reset at market value during option exercise periods. Sorry, or periodically during the term of a lease that will be more than the typical, 10-year lease that you might find in an office building. You will find them often in earnouts. An earnout is a contract by which you sell a piece of property or somebody buys a piece of property, and you get paid initially, and then there is you get paid sometime subsequent to the ownership based on the performance standard that the new owner obtains out of the property, or their expectations to obtain out of the property. You will also find them frequently in zoning matters, and Tony's going to talk more about how they get used in zoning matters. And you may also find them in buy-sell provisions, which is another very, very common method of utilization of an appraisal. Tony, have I missed any that you want to mention?
No, I think those are the three biggest ones that come to mind, Dick, and we ought to plunge into them, I'd say.
Yeah, well, let's do the rent reset, because that to me has been the one that I most commonly come across. And let's talk about the long-term ground lease before we talk a little bit about the space lease. Long-term ground leases will have a rental period. But it is clearly people don't want to have the rent reset. To sit down and try and pick a rent reset, let's take a 30-year ground lease, which is not a bad, untypical term. If I rent this piece of property, a ground or even a ground improved to Tony in today's terms, and I certainly do not want to rent it for 30 years at the same basis. And frankly, I've seen people use index methods, most frequently the CPI. Make sure if you're going to use the CPI, by the way, that you use the right CPI. You need to be definitive. I'm not suggesting that you do that, by the way, because I think using the CPI is a completely artificial method of valuing real estate. It has nothing to do with the value of real estate. Typical people that CPI that people use is the all city average throughout the United States. That may even specify the one for the metropolitan area in which you're in, if indeed there is a metropolitan area CPI for your locale. But I will tell you that that kind of inflation really has nothing to do with real estate. It has to do with the price of eggs, meat, paint. But very, very, very little of that has to do with rental value. So people will say that after a period of time, we're going to reset the rent. And the methodology for resetting the rent is typically has people using appraisers. And the appraiser is asked, and we're going to talk about drafting appraisal clauses when we're done with these uses. So I don't want to dwell on that at the moment because that's a separate and important, discrete topic. But typically there will be an appraiser. The problem is sometimes people will name an appraiser. That's very, very interesting because you're going to name an appraiser on a 30-year ground lease. You better pick somebody young because you can't ensure that they're going to be around. They're going to continue.
Yep.
There are several methods. One, the two parties can agree at the time on a single appraiser. The two parties can each say, I'm going to pick my own appraiser. They're going to do the appraisal. And if they're within 10% of each other, we'll take an average. And if they're not within 10% of each other, we will have a mechanism to decide how to do it. And there are multiple variations on that. Tony, if you want to explain those variations, that would be great.
Sure.
What happens when the two don't match?
Sure. And as Dick says, there's lots of different ways to deal with that. You'll commonly hear people talk about something called baseball arbitration clause. And in that situation, first of all, if each side picks an appraiser, they come in with their own numbers, and typically the clause will say if they're within 10% of each other, you take the average. If they're not, then you have to have a mechanism for what you do to resolve it. And sometimes you pick a third appraiser, and the third appraiser then can do one of several things. Maybe he does his own appraisal, and that is the one you use, and you toss the first two. Another alternative is you pick a third appraiser, and the third appraiser's task is to pick which of the first two is closer to the real one, to the, what he thinks the real number is, and that's what we call baseball arbitration. And that's a that's a tough one to be in, Dick. I don't know about your experience with it, but because you're, you know, you have no way of knowing what the third appraiser is going to pick.
I see that used more and more often, Tony.
People tend
to like it. What they don't realize, however, living in my condominium is a labor lawyer, a woman who is one of the baseball and hockey arbitrators.
Yep.
And as she said, she never sits anymore because they always, before they arbitrate, they always come to agreement.
Yeah, because nobody wants to put it into the hands of the third party.
That's
anyway,
right.
A third way that you'll see people deal with this appraisal issue when they're more than 10% apart is you pick the third person, and the third person does their appraisal. And then what you do is you take the two that are closest to each other and average those. So there's a lot of permutations that you can take in drafting these clauses, but those are the principal ones that we've seen.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. Again, you don't specify the appraisers; you pick them at the time, because the people you might specify may not be in business, you may not like them, they may change. You know, Lord knows what can happen. But I would suggest that is really an important way to do a rent reset is to use some form of appraisal mechanism. We'll talk about how you draft it later, as I said, but, you know, that is really critical. Space leases. Let's turn for a moment to space leases. I've seen fair market value resets on long-term space leases.
Yes.
By long-term, I mean 10 years or more. And what happens is, and the mechanism, I've seen people use appraisers, but frankly, I think the appraisers are... it's overblown and expensive. I like to use brokers.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sit down there and do the same thing that we just described, except instead of using real estate appraisers, you use brokers. Number one, brokers are likely to do this either for no compensation or for much less compensation than an appraiser will do. Number two, they are not beset with the standards that Tony described. But who has a better opinion of what market value is for a full floor office building than the brokers in the community where the full floor office building sits?
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, in space leases, I rarely see appraisers. I do see I see the utilization of rental resets that occur with using real estate brokers. You do what you want. You either both pick one. Or you pick two, and you go through the same kind of mechanism that you see. But this to me is the kind of definitive use and most important use that I've seen of appraisal clauses. Is in long term occupancy rental resets. So they are really, really critical. Let's talk about buy sells because they are really the most. That's
did
the
you
second
want to do
most.
That, or did you want to do zoning second?
Well, we can do zoning second. Go ahead if you would like to go ahead and do zoning.
It doesn't matter, but zoning.
We
had talked about zoning as an area. What if you're in a development deal? almost anywhere in America, you're going to be involved with an entitlement process. So there's most of these communities in the country now have written their zoning laws so that you almost cannot develop anything without tripping over some regulatory requirement that ends up with a process in front of a local government. And typically that involves hearings in front of either city councils or plan commissions or similar types of organizations. And so it's very common in these a number of these hearings that the ordinance that you're operating under will say that it's a requirement that you demonstrate that to get the zoning relief or change that you want, there be no adverse impact on adjoining property values. And, of course, that presents the opponents with an opportunity to come in and say, well, this project is going to be bad for property values in the neighborhood. And then the burden will be on, if you're a development lawyer, proving up that that's not so, that there will be no adverse impact. And generally, the only way you can do that in a case that could end up getting taken to court by the opponents, you have to make a record in that zoning case that requirement, no adverse impact, was met and satisfied. And the way you do that is you have to put expert testimony on, and the experts that you call on typically are MAI appraisers. The point that we want to emphasize in the program today is that the MAI appraiser category distinction is one that is earned by long study and compliance with all their requirements and much learning, and it's a distinguished profession, and the complicated work and all of that stuff, fine professional people. But we're talking about a hearing process here, and we're talking about somebody serving as an expert witness. So if you're going to be in that situation in a development deal and getting an appraisal, you want to be sure and interview the appraisal firm, and in particular, you want to interview the person they will designate as their witness if you're going to be in the hearing. And the reason that is so critically important is that if you've ever been in one of these cases and the appraiser gets up and they haven't been carefully selected, you'll find that they wither under cross-examination sometimes. They weren't expecting to be in a contested situation. So I always, when we're in these cases, we make it a point. In fact, we've developed now a good working list of folks that we like to work with. And the client will usually ask us for a recommendation, and we try to pick people who we know will be able to not only, you know, obviously do their research and be able to make the conclusion that we want them to be able to make, but also, more importantly, they'll be able to handle themselves well in the fight that is likely to erupt and won't start getting wishy-washy or backing off of their conclusion or wilting under tough questioning, you know, and sometimes these appraisers get literally cross-examined. The opponents have lawyers there, and those, you know, they usually bring a litigator type who wants to get up there and, you know, play Perry Mason and start this withering cross-examination saying, Mr. Appraiser, did you consider this? And Mr. Appraiser, did you consider that? And so you have to be prepared with all of that. And again, not all MAI appraisers are equally good at that role. And so that's what we wanted to call to your attention for purposes of the zoning use of the appraisal. Dick, you want to move over to buy sells now? Or?
Yeah. I just for one moment, I would like to emphasize what Tony said, which is if you're going to do this in the zoning context, I think it's really critical that you as a law firm interview the appraiser.
Yep.
I suggest to your client may not want to do that because it's not free.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, interview the appraiser to make sure if you're in a contested in something where there is going to be some kind of contest, that you have somebody who can that will satisfactorily stand up. But Tony couldn't be more correct that your appraiser can lose your case as well as win your case. I have enormous respect for MAI appraisers. They go through a huge amount of coursework, written work, submission of appraisals, review by their peers in order to get the designation, and it is one of the most significant designations you can receive. But as I said, they're not all created equal. Some are just wonderful appraisers, but not great witnesses. So Tony is totally correct. Let's move over to buy sell, where this is really an important, very, very important use of appraisers. And let's first talk a little bit about buy sells, although they're not the subject of this course, but I think you have to understand what happens when you're in a buy sell situation in some form of joint venture, some form of limited liability company today, which permits a buy sell. Just a brief word off the subject that I would really I urge all lawyers to at least try to investigate if you have a client that you feel is less sophisticated than you might expect them to be. If they're going to be doing a joint venture, and the typical joint venture is not really through two sponsors, because what you're talking about are two people who are both penniless, and their egos will not fit into your office. So the typical joint venture is really a money partner or partners and a sponsor.
Yep.
The way I've grown to, even though when I worked for my developer, we were a publicly traded Fortune 500 company, we were not impecunious. Most sponsors, compared to the people who are investing in them, can be best called impecunious. That means that the people who have the money can raise the money very quickly, but you can't raise the money very, very quickly when you're the sponsor. You're not liquid. You depend on financing, and so when you're doing a buy sell agreement, one of the things I urge the people who represent the sponsors or the developers to do. And frequently, good money partners will agree to this, is that there be an imbalance in time for execution of the buy-sell.
Correct.
That is, the sponsor gets more time to come up with money than the money people have. And if you're dealing with somebody who says no to that, you need to at least have a long talk with your client about those implications and whether or not, they can raise, $10 million in 30 days. So the important part of buy-sells. The typical buy-sell mechanism that you have, it's called by a bunch of different names, and Tony and I are conversation. Tony, you call it a shotgun, I call it Russian roulette, and that is the party who would like to terminate the joint venture. And just a word before that, make sure also that your client and their money partner, when they start this relationship, have similar expectations for holding periods. Without going into a lot of detail, most of the time the sponsors get their money at what's called a promote. That is, they get a disproportionate share of cash and sales proceeds after certain targets are reached. And if you have if you don't have a commonality of holding period and commonality of objective, the money partner can very, very easily deprive the promoter of all of their expectations for receiving the promote, which is
correct,
where they really make their money.
Yep.
And frequently the promotes do not occur until the property is sold.
Yep.
So if you have a too early a trigger because you've picked the wrong partner, what you're going to get for your sweat will be a towel instead of a steam bath. So I would suggest that's a very, very important thing. But the typical buy sell says, as what I call Russian roulette and Tony calls shotgun, somebody names a price, and the other party decides whether they want to be a buyer or a seller. Now, that sounds pretty draconian because, number one, I name a price, and I don't know what's going to happen to me. If I'm going to be the seller, I may not want it. Maybe my baby that I've just put up, if I'm the sponsor, I may not want to. I may not want that kind of choice to be made. Or it may be at the wrong time, for various different kinds of market conditions that vary for the sponsor and for the money partner. So the Russian roulette, the beauty of Russian roulette is in the practice. Aubrey was kind enough to credit me with 40 years of practice. It's actually 50. I've had a number of different joint ventures, and I've only seen the Russian roulette. It wasn't really Russian roulette. It was a bidding process. Go through to the end one time. And I've done a bunch of these. So I would say to you that the beauty of the Russian roulette is it never happens. Has that been your experience, Tony?
At
the parties,
I would
usually
say,
come to some accommodation.
I would never is too tough of a word. I would say rarely, and the reason is Dick indicated is that the process that's typically put in place, and our topic today is appraisals, and sometimes these buy-sell provisions have a mechanism for an appraisal if there's an impasse on valuation. We'll get to that in a second. But what happens is that once you implement that process, once you launch that missile, you've lost control because, as Dick indicated, when you trigger it, a mechanism occurs where you could be the buyer or you could be the seller, depending on how the price gets either set by the person making the offer, or if you have an appraisal mechanism, it's even more out of your control. So Dick is right. I've actually been through several of these where they did actually people got so far apart that they couldn't stand each other anymore, or they had typically these come about, Dick, when there's a disagreement about decision making. You know, there's some particular tenant, and one side wants to put that tenant in, and the other side think they're going to be bad for the property, or there's a disagreement about how we should finance it. Should we take a 5-year loan or a longer term loan? So people can get into bona fide business disputes and decide that they're not happy with their partner anymore and they want to exit. The trick is to you know, have a mechanism that allows that to occur in a timely way. I want to mention you also want those provisions to be specifically enforceable. We had an involvement in a case in Chicago. Fortunately, we did not draft the buy-sell clause itself, but we had some involvement subsequent to the parties being into the mechanism where the clause was triggered. One side exercised their right to buy, and then they defaulted. So the other side sued for specific performance, and the court, federal court, refused specific performance because the clause in hand did not allow for specific performance. So there's a drafting pointer, Dick. Maybe we're ahead of the horse, ahead of the cart.
No, I think that's a good point, and it's right place to make it. Let's move to the appraisal side of this, because frequently people do not use Russian roulette or shotguns, but they will use an appraisal mechanism to unwind. And the appraisal mechanism, again, it's not unlike the lease reset. The same kinds of rules apply. If you can, you clearly do not, you know, these are fairly long-term relationships. The parties can do the same thing, and let's review them again. They can agree to pick a single appraiser. They can agree to pick two appraisers and agree that if they're within a certain value range, you average them. They can agree to baseball, where the higher number is the one that is the number they pick, or they can agree that the lower number is the one that they pick. I don't think I've ever seen that, but anything is possible. Or they can agree to the three, you know, if the two are not within some kind of consistent standard, to bring in a third and have the third do all the things that we discussed before, which is to either select one or the other, or to average the two, come up with their own number and average the three, or to disregard the other two and have the third appraiser be the definitive person. Again, we'll talk in a few moments about the conditions for drafting appraisal clauses and how you should do this, but for the most part, those are the mechanisms that you see in joint ventures, and every joint venture agreement I've ever seen has some mechanism, whether it's the Russian roulette, or now people will use appraisals. I mean, Tony and I like Russian roulette because, frankly, what it really forces the parties to do is to sit down and talk to each other. They don't like the result of Russian roulette. And
yep.
So they frequently, as I said, I've only seen it happen once.
Yeah.
And it was not really a Russian roulette situation. It was a bid. This is another way you can do it. You can just continually bid. Each party will bid a price that they will pay to take the other party out. And then the
yep.
other party has can either say yes or can rebid. And the one time that this was, it wasn't really Russian roulette, it was a bid situation. It was a two major United, I worked for a major United States developer who was publicly traded, and it was the Rouse Company of Columbia, Maryland, which was bought out by General Growth, but it was one of the largest real estate companies in the world, and Westfield came into the market from Australia, which is now one of the largest is probably the largest real estate company in the world. And Westfield and Rouse did Westfield's first deal was a joint venture, and we were the development partner because they did not have a development office, and everybody kept bidding until finally we determined that and the Rouse company had never sold anything; it was not part of the culture. Finally, determined this would be the first time because the bid was so great that and the other side was happy to get it, and we were happy to get the money because. This has been, we had owned it for 2 years and doubled our investment. So there's, that's another mechanism you can do is to do a bid situation.
Yeah.
Where the parties get together. And it helps, it really the best way to kind of figure this out is to get some sense. The recommendation is to try and get some sense as to the parties, two things about the parties. One, the relative power. And typically speaking, the money partner has the power. But sometimes you'll represent somebody who also has some, some skin in the game. And the second thing is that the question is, what's their relationship? Do they have a long-standing relationship where they've done this before? Is this the first time? Do they appear to get along with each other when you're doing this negotiation, or are you at each other's throats? And I think you have to analyze this a little bit before you determine which kind of mechanism you're going to use. And obviously, you have to understand your client and your client's capacity to be able to react in the period of time. That gets back to, if you're representing the sponsor, you need more time. It doesn't help for you to have a buy-sell where you have 30 days to come up with $50 million, unless you happen to be a sponsor who is usually successful. For the money people to come up with $50 million is probably easier. I won't say it's easy because it also depends on who the money partner is. If the money partner is a consortium of individuals, it's going to be easier, but not that easy. If your money partner is a life insurance company or some other, finance company or some other form of investor that has money, laying around just waiting to be, put to use, you can't react anywhere close to the time frame. So again, time frames are very, very important in these joint venture type agreements in order to figure out what we're, what the parties are going how the parties are going to be able to react.
Dick, any other drafting pointers we should spend?
I think I want to spend the rest of our time talking about the appraisals and drafting pointers. But can you think of any situation we need to cover that we haven't covered in terms of the use of these?
Pretty well covered those issues in terms of situations where the appraiser use comes up. So go ahead.
But let's talk. We said we were not going to talk about the standards for appraisal, and I think that's a really good idea because I haven't read that in years, and I have I know how appraisers function, but let's talk for a moment about actually what they do at a very basic level. Appraisers are due to come up with fair market value based on some standard, and we're going to get to that later, but just understand it's based on some standard. And what is the typical approach that appraisers use? They will use three standards. They will use, first of all, a comparable sales standard. They will look for sales that are similar to the property that they're appraising and analyze the property that they were appraising, analyze the property that sold, and come up with a list of pluses and minuses, that is, incremental things in the condition of the income stream, the property, and everything else that will cause them to either raise the comparable sale or reduce the comparable sale because the factors are different. Comparable sales are something that is most effectively used. Frankly, it's almost exclusively used in homes. That's the only thing they use. You know, in evaluating your residence, they'll use comparable sales because because there is no income approach to your house, and the third approach is reproduction and replacement cost, which we'll talk about in a minute. But when you're talking about a commercial piece of property, they are sometimes, if you have something that is sui generis, it is very, very difficult to to deal with. For example, hotels. I mean, you could have a number of hotels that sell in the marketplace, but are they the factors that go into make their comparability is just it's just enormous. It is finite, but it's enormous. The larger and the more complex the piece of real estate is, the more difficult the use of the comparable sale approach is. Mm-hmm. The second approach, which is typically an income-producing property, one of the most valid, and for which comparable sales are a test, is to really take a look at the net income from the property, its income and expenses, to stabilize them for past years and future years, and to sit down and come up with what you think the present value of the future income is likely to be, and to thus appraise the property based on the present value. You know, again, modifying it where it needs to be modified, where it's out of line for, you know, for example, you could have a particular situation where you would not use, income, or you might not project income, you'd have a growth rate, and then to capitalize that based on what you think the cap rate would be, cap rate being the property value divided by the net income from the property divided by a rate that you select, which is a rate at which you think other properties would similarly trade. It's usually a percentage, so it's like dividing 0.05 into $100,000 gives you a $2 million value. That's using a cap rate and coming with a value based on your view of the income stream. Yep. That in an income-producing property is the most commonly used, and I would like to suggest the most valid way of doing it. Tony, do you agree with that piece of it?
I do.
Disagree?
And I do agree that with that, and the issue with the income-producing property valuations is always what's the rate. Two issues, really. Number one, if there are leases in the property, you have to typically assume, Dick, that those leases, when they turn over, will be relet on some set of assumed terms, which have to be factored into your discounted cash flow analysis. So there's a lot of room there for disagreement about what those assumptions ought to be. And then the second factor, as you indicated, is what is the rate of return that is a market rate that it would be expected by buyers and investors? And that is a harder number to come up with than you might think. Different investors have different time horizons. Different investors have different liquidity needs. Different investors have different objectives for their portfolios. And so coming up with a capitalization rate, where that is, you take the income from a property and you divide it by the rate of return you desire to earn to get the amount of money that you would pay for that. You know, if you have $100 of income and you're trying to make a 10% rate of return, if you divide $100 by 10%, you get $1,000 value. So somebody would pay $1,000 for the property at a 10% rate of return to get the $100 of income that's there. That's what the whole income analysis does. And where the arguments come in is, number one, how are you calculating that income? Are you making assumptions about rollover leases and so forth? And number two, what is that rate of return? And you can, you know, have considerable squabbles about that in these situations.
Yeah, again, you know, you are projecting out income but it's very it's harder to project that rate of return. More likely the rate of return is what the market expects at that particular point in time.
Yeah.
So you're really measuring two different variables on two different bases when you come up with it, but it is still the most commonly used in income-producing pieces of property, which is what most of us are involved in. The third method they use is what they call replacement and reproduction cost. Replacement cost is what would it cost you to replace the property. Reproduction cost is what would it cost you to rebuild the property. And if it's old, you would have to use certain kinds of depreciation values that come in there. My experience with reproduction cost is in most commercial deals, reproduction cost is nothing but simply a check.
That's right.
Of the other two, they don't really get used, because who cares what it costs? The real thing is how much am I going to make. Whenever we talk about commercial real estate, I hold true and dear that the leases are the only thing that count, and everything else is a minus. Because the income is what you get, and
income is what you get to keep.
Owning a piece of land means you have obligations,
right?
And it does is house the thing that gets you the income, which are the leases and the other streams of revenue. You know, when you talk about complex things like huge enclosed regional malls, you're not just talking about rents.
Yep.
You're talking about all kinds of income streams that are very, very different. You know, I was going to say in the old days, you know, when I first started doing malls, the income stream was the rents. Now, in heaven's name knows, I got credit cards, merry-go-rounds, concessions, carts, all of which would bear a different kind of analysis.
Sure.
Than a lease, because they're less permanent, and they are more like owning personal property or intangible rights than they are owning real estate.
Right.
But that reproduction cost is the third way they do it.
Sure. Well, to come back to the income item for one just second, the reason that rate of return calculation is harder than people might initially think, you might say, well, why is that so hard? Go look at the 10-year Treasury bond rate and then add some margin to that, and that's the number. It can't quite do it that way, and the reason is that the income stream itself, to the extent that it's being generated by tenants, Dick, I know you appreciate this, different tenants have different credit ratings. So you might take a lower rate of return if your tenant is a high credit tenant, and you would want a higher rate of return if it's a low credit tenant. Mm-hmm. And so the appraiser has a lot of discretion in there, Dick, to pick, you know, rates of return based upon the credit worthiness of the tenant income stream. And the second thing I wanted to mention on the coming back to the comparable issue, and this is another point again for our maybe a drafting point again for our listeners, I may be overly sensitive to this because I just went through this a couple months ago in a squawk situation where people were squawking with each other over, and we had to resort to appraisals. The different appraisers can differ about what is a quote comparable property. So if you're drafting these clauses, you might want to try to specify, you know, the appraisers will be instructed to look at comparable properties, which for these purposes mean you might put a radius clause in there, properties within a certain distance of the property in question. The one we had our squabble about, the property happened to be on, it was a lakefront property on Lake Michigan, and the other side's appraiser was trying to use comparables that were not lakefront properties. Well, obviously, properties fronting on the lake tend to have higher valuations because of the view and the lakefront amenities. They also have big, as Dick said earlier, owning a property like that's a huge responsibility because you have serious erosion and other issues with the lake, you know, eroding your bluff, everything else. So, you know, it's a complex analysis. And so when you're drafting one of these things that the appraiser is going to use comparables, try to get some parameters around which the appraisers are going to draw their comparables.
Yeah,
Dick,
I think be careful,
those?
Though. I say, oh, I do agree with you. But, you know, be careful. Don't go out to 2050 because where I'm sitting is likely to be underwater. So we can't. This is a good segue, Tony, into drafting appraisal clauses, which to me has been a pet peeve of my life forever. And let me tell you what my pet peeve is. My pet peeve is that when you look at appraisal clauses, people go to great lengths to provide the mechanism for the appraisal. How it's going to get done, when it's going to get done, how the parties select, if there's a dispute, who appoints the appraiser, you know, and all of the things about the mechanics of getting the appraisal done. But they forget something. The agreement has better tell the appraiser what to appraise with great precision. And I've seen clauses that are just insane because they forget it. And therefore, the appraisers look at you and say, what do you want me to do here? What standard should I use? Let me give you a case that occurred in New York. It was the Plaza Hotel, which sat on a long-term ground lease with an appraisal rental reset. And they did give the appraiser instructions. They gave the appraiser the instructions to appraise the Plaza Hotel for its highest and best use, unencumbered by the building and unencumbered by the existing by the zoning code at the time it was built. Now, the Plaza Hotel, as you all know, is one of a very valuable piece of real estate. It sits on 58th, 59th Street on Central Park West. It is surrounded by, you know, things like the CBS Tower, the General Motors Tower, you know, 70, 80-foot skyscrapers. And so when the appraisers came in, they did exactly what they were instructed to do, and they came up with a rent, an annual ground rent that was probably worth more than every year, more than the hotel was worth. Somebody simply missed out on the notion that you should never, ever include a clause that puts no restrictions on the appraiser. The most important thing you can draft is what they're appraising. And what they really ought to be appraising is the property subject to its existing improvements, subject to its existing code or the original code when adopted, whichever was more restrictive. And it should be, again, subject to the use to which it is put, presently being put, and the value of the improvements, especially if you're just doing land, the value of the improvements as they sit on top of it. If you are not that precise, you will end up having a ground lessor who will become, be incredibly happy, and a ground lessee who will say, I can't afford it. People need to really, really be very, very careful as to how they define what it is that the appraiser will appraise. And I think that, you know, if your party has hired an appraiser, well, they probably won't hire an appraiser, you ought to be consulting with an appraiser to get some of these conditions out. But bear in mind that the important part of drafting these clauses is making sure that if you're dealing with existing improvements, that it is subject to that which is there and the use to which it is made. Because without that, you've just been given a blank check. It really is a mess, and people spend no time at all giving instructions to the appraiser. I mean, Tony just gave you one about comparable sales. Yep. You know, they ought to put in a radius, or if it's a lakefront property, you only use lakefront properties. It is crucial, especially if you're representing the ground lessee, that you define the utility to which the property is being presently used. Now, if you have the right to rebuild the property, that's fine. And you're going to rebuild the property. The mechanism that you want to use is that which may to which it may be used. But if you're in the middle of a construction period, you can take into consideration the effect of the contemplated use. But never, ever give a blank check. Yep. And forget the whole mechanism junk. That's the other thing that really I love. I love the clause that says the parties can't agree, they will apply to the chief judge of the federal district court, who will decide who the appraiser is. Who do we think we are that we can confer jurisdiction on a chief judge to take on that task? I mean, after all, we are not writing the Constitution.
Yeah.
I don't think it's part of their duties. And frankly, in some places, they will just tell you to go jump in the lake. So you really need to have a...
I had a clause once where parties agreed that if they couldn't agree on the appraiser, that they would apply to the cardinal of the Archdiocese of Chicago for the selection. And I remember reading that thinking, they must not have been serious. They must have thought they were never, ever going to have to exercise that.
That's
I had
right.
a vision of trying to go in and ask the cardinal. I can't right. even get in front of the cardinal to ask
right.
him, let alone get him to make a decision like that.
Yeah.
And we probably have about the same luck with the chief yeah. judge of the federal district court, too, by the way.
Yeah, so, I think if you're going to confer jurisdiction, you'd better figure out who it is.
Yeah.
On the other hand, by the way, so most people say, well, I don't know who it is because this could be years from now, so I need to have some, you know, figurehead. Well, make sure if it's a figurehead, for example, one of the good figureheads to use would be the president of the chapter of the American Institute in your locality. I've seen
yeah.
that. That can work.
Yeah.
Again, bear in mind that sometimes, you know, the president of the chapter of your particular local American Institute of Appraisers may have some biases here. They may not like the other two appraisers that you've appointed or one of them. But again, they will in fact appoint an appraiser if you ask them to do that because it's
yep.
in their pecuniary interest to do it. But please, you know, do not confer jurisdiction on, you know, on President Trump. The Secretary of State, the ambassador from, you know, from Ireland, or some
cardinal
some
of
judge.
The archdiocese,
cardinal
right?
of the archdiocese, yeah.
The other one, the other point that you might want to think about in these, I've tried to do this a couple times. Some of these real estate companies that might be in these appraisal clauses, Dick, are big nationwide companies. And the appraisal companies have been consolidating somewhat, too. So I like to say that a party may not pick an appraiser that it has used in an appraisal setting in the last 12 or 24 months or something like that, on the theory that I don't want somebody picking an appraiser who is a regular, ongoing customer of that client, or vendor, rather, to that client. I want the appraiser. I understand they have professional responsibilities and ethical obligations, and I get all that. But still, I don't want somebody, you know, picking their standard appraiser because the company gives them 20 assignments a year. I don't want the. You know, human beings can suffer from temptation, Dick, and even ethical and highly qualified people can suffer from temptation. And if you're going to lock yourself into a clause that has consequences of the outcome of picking the appraisers, you might be well advised, I think, to say that the other side can't hire somebody that they use all the time for their appraisal work. Have you run into that one, or...
No, I really haven't, but that's an excellent point.
This, yeah.
Appraisals, don't think of appraisals as arbitrations. They are not.
No.
They are not. Unless you, I don't want to make them subject to the rules of the American Arbitration Association. I specifically would make sure they are not subject to the rules of the American Arbitration Association because it is not an arbitration. An appraisal and an arbitration are completely different things. Because in an arbitration, when you have a three arbitration situation, you do pick your best friend as your arbitrator.
Yep.
You know, if you think you're going to, I'm going to go out here, I'm going to find some really honest, ethical human being, what you're going to find is that they're going to be up against the best friend of the other party, who also has something to say about who the third arbitrator is. So,
right.
you know, appraisals and arbitrations, bear in mind they have different legal consequences and different legal rules. And the appraisal situation ought to be made subject to the rules of the American Institute and not subject to the rules of the American Arbitration Association, which I think is an important and pretty clear distinction. Well, Tony, anything
okay.
else that we have before we turn this over to the operator for questions?
No, I think we've touched on all the topics we wanted to get to, and it's a good time to go ahead.
Okay. All right, well, operator, it's time to open the program for questions. Could you please provide our listeners with their instructions?
If you wish to ask a question, please press star key on your touch-tone phone, followed by the 1 key. That's star 1. To get out of queue, please press pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Tony, while we're waiting for questions, Liz, let me ask you a question on the buy-sell side. I mean, how often have you seen the buy-sell, you know, these buy-sell provisions actually as drafted work, and how often do you see them, the parties just say, I can't stand this anymore, let's talk?
I would guess that in all of the ones that we've done, which have been numerous times, the number of trigger situations is probably, I would guess, less than 10%, believe it or not. And because the whole construct, as Dick and I have been talking about, the whole construct of these things is intended to have a finality to them, which means that the both sides are giving up control. And the really well-drafted ones, Dick, have the intention of causing the people to sit down and want to work it out, because each side is giving up control and you may not like the outcome. And so a well-drafted clause, as I say, provides powerful incentives to actually do come to an agreement, avoid the operation of the highly mechanical process. But it's useful to have that mechanical process, because if the other side is being unreasonable or unrealistic in their expectations or their demands, at some point you got to just pull the trigger and go with the flow and let the chips fall where they may, just to get out of the darn thing.
Okay, well, thank you, Tony. Operator, are there any questions for us today?
There are no questions at this time.
Well, then, thank you, everyone, for listening. We've gone through all of our time. If you're not able to ask a question or one occurs to you later, you have Tony's contact information and my contact information, and we would be delighted to help you in any way that we can. This is Dick Goldberg, and on behalf of Tony Lacana and myself, thank you for joining us today.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's broadcast.